this morning is in the Gospel of Mark. We're going to begin at chapter 15 and verse 21, and we're going to read to verse 39. The Gospel of Mark, chapter 15, beginning at verse 21. I was just, as I was reading this over beforehand, it is packed with details. Just see if you can notice some of them. There are so many little details in here that just sort of stand out when you stop and think about it for a moment. And they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. And they brought him to a place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull. And they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide which each of them should take. And it was the third hour when they crucified him. And the inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And with him they crucified two robbers, one on his right and one on his left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "Aha! You who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." So also the chief priests and scribes mocked him to one another, saying, "He saved others. He cannot save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross, that we may see and believe." Those who were crucified with him also reviled him. And when it came to the sixth hour, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. At the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And some of the bypassers, hearing it, said, "Behold, he is calling Elijah." And someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine and put it on a reed and gave him to drink, saying, "Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come and take him down." And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood facing him saw in this way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." May God bless this reading of his word this morning.
The crucifixion and the resurrection of God's Son, Jesus the Christ, is central to, it's foundational to the Christian faith. Without Jesus coming and dying and rising again in history, the Christian faith is useless, and we'd be fools to have gathered in his name here if he had not actually in history died and rose again from the dead. That being true, many of you have studied the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. You have read the accounts over and over again. You have heard many teachings and explanations about the crucifixion and the resurrection of Jesus. And that is good. We want to keep repeatedly studying and learning and growing about what Jesus actually did that day on that cross. Even now as we approach Good Friday, perhaps you're already thinking about the details of the crucifixion and the things that went on that day, and those details are starting to buzz like bees in your mind as you reflect upon it and prepare for the coming weekend. But even so, as we approach the account of the crucifixion, as we just read or was read in Mark 15, we should carefully note what is actually there and what is missing or what is left out of the account, so that we actually understand what the author of the Gospel of Mark is trying to emphasize. The first thing we should note is how austere or sparse the description of the actual crucifixion is. It just simply says in verse 24, "And they crucified him." There's no physical description. There's no details of how they actually, crucified him. There's no description of the nails. Not even a description of what type of cross he was crucified on. There's no description of the physical suffering and the pain. And that's a bit different than our often contemporary reflections on the cross. When we think about the cross, we think very much of the physical agony. We think of the blood and the nails and the thorns and the lashes on his back. Now, that's not wrong to think about those things. We need to think about those things. We need to understand those things. But as we look at this text, as the Gospel of Mark speaks of the crucifixion, it leaves the physical suffering. It doesn't describe it here. It focuses on something else. Though this sparse description does forcefully remind us of something that's important. It reminds us that our forgiveness of our sin, our being reconciled with God, is based on an event that actually occurred in history. And they crucified him. Now, it does mention in verse 21 that there was a man named Simon of Cyrene. He was forced to help carry Jesus' cross. There is something that we could perhaps correct here. In our contemporary understanding of Jesus' crucifixion, usually in the movies, movies of the last few decades, in our plays, we have Jesus carrying an entire cross. Both pieces, the cross piece and the vertical piece. But actually, how they carried their cross, the condemned criminal, was they only carried one piece. The cross had two pieces, the vertical piece and the cross piece, the cross beam. So at the place of condemnation, as they led them out, or before they led them out, they would take the cross piece, as you see in the picture, and they would put that across your back and tie your arms to it. And then they would say, "March to where you're going to be crucified." And at the place of crucifixion, the vertical beam would already be there in the ground. And when you got there, they would nail you to the cross piece and then lift the cross piece with you attached and stick it onto the vertical stake in the ground. Jesus was so weak from the beating and the scourging that he couldn't even carry the crossbeam, and he needed help. The second thing that we should note that's missing is not just that it does not describe the physical details of the actual crucifying, nailing him to the cross, and all that physical suffering. There's a lot of positive elements that are missing. When you compare it to the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Luke and the Gospel of John, you'll see that Mark leaves out that saying, that gracious saying, "Father, forgive them, they do not know what they do." Mark leaves out the part of the family and some friends being at the foot of the cross. He leaves that positive element out. There's no peaceful saying from Jesus' lips, "Into your hands I commend my spirit." There's no crucified thief sticking up for Jesus. In this account, they're both mocking him. There's no triumphant, "It is finished." So where's the emphasis? What is Mark trying to get us to understand when we read this gospel? What is one of the key themes? What is one of the key things that he wants us to grasp? And what it is the mockery of Jesus that he's enduring. The scorning of Jesus, verses 29 to 32, is all this mocking. Yes, Jesus has been mocked all through this experience, right from the beginning of his arrest and the preliminary trial in the house of the high priest. They mocked him there. The high priest and the Sanhedrin mocked him. Last week, your text that Peter preached on, the soldiers, before they led him out to be crucified, the soldiers mocked him. But now at the cross, it reaches a climax where all sorts of people are coming and mocking him. It says in verse 29, "And those who passed by derided him." So just Joe Blow and Jane Doe passing along on the path. I mean, they put the crucifixions in the most busiest places, the most busiest intersections where people traveled. And so these people are traveling by, and it's not just the priests, it's not just the soldiers. Now everybody's joining in, mocking him. It's not just the gloating priest and religious leaders or the callous soldiers, but it's the general public who's mocking Jesus. And not only that, it's the thieves crucified on both sides of him. They're rightly condemned. They deserve to die. They're just as in a helpless state as Jesus is, and yet they take that moment to take pot shots at Jesus and mock him. Now, this mocking contains three powerful ironic realities. When you look at the mocking and what is being said, it reveals a number of things. The first thing, or the first irony, is it reveals who the real blasphemers are. It's those shouting at Jesus. Now, if you go back to chapter 14, verse 64, the chief priest, the Sanhedrin, why did they condemn Jesus to death? In their minds, in Mark 14, it was because he committed blasphemy. They said, "Jesus, you just said blasphemy," because the high priest had put Jesus under oath and said, "Tell me, are you really the Son of God? Are you the Christ of God?" And Jesus says, "Yes, I am. And you're going to see me come in the clouds with power and see me seated at the right hand of God." And they go, "Blasphemy." What's blasphemy? Blasphemy is a profane or contemptuous speech. It's a speech of attacking God, seeking to rob him of his glory, lessen and insult his character and his being and his glory. That's blasphemy. And so the high priest in chapter 14 is saying, "Jesus, you have committed blasphemy by your claiming to be the Son of God, to be the Christ, to be coming in the clouds of power. This is a deriding, it's a condemning and insulting of God. Therefore, you're deserving of death." You see, the chief priest believed that Jesus was just a false prophet, a person, a man possessed by a demon. And for him to claim to be the Christ of God, the deliverer whom God has sent, that's blasphemy. That's an attack upon God and his glory in his mind. Now in verse 29 in the ESV, it says, "And those who passed by derided him." The word behind derided is in the Greek is blaspheme. Some of your other English translations would have translated it saying blaspheme. In the ESV, it says derided. So it's saying here, really, the real blasphemers are the people shouting and mocking Jesus on the cross. Because the truth is, he is the Christ. He is the Messiah. He is the glory of God. And so to insult and demean and shame Jesus through their words is for them. They're the blasphemers, not Jesus. It's they who are attacking the glory of God in their contemptuous taunts that they hurl at Jesus. So there's the first irony. The second irony is Jesus' crucifixion, including the mockery, is not a sign of Jesus' failure, but it's a sign of his successful fulfilling of God's will according to the scripture. That is quite an irony. In chapter 14 of Mark, verse 49, when the mob came to arrest Jesus in the garden, what was the last thing that Jesus said to the mob? He said in verse 49, "But let the scriptures be fulfilled." The prophecy that Jesus would be scorned, mocked, and reviled is found in Psalm 22, verses 6 to 8, and it reads, "But I am a worm and not a man, scorned by mankind and despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They make mouths at me. They wag their heads. He trusts in the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, for he delights in him." But in Psalm 22, it's not just the mocking that is foretold about Jesus' crucifixion. There are other things out of Mark 15 that are also there. So in Mark 15, 24, you have the thing about them dividing his garments, casting lots. That is mentioned in Psalm 22, verse 18. In Mark 15, you see how Jesus is surrounded at the cross by evildoers and people who are mocking him and blaspheming him and hurling insults at him. Well, that being encircled and surrounded by evildoers is referred to in Psalm 22, verse 16. The cry of forsakenness in verse 34. You know, my God, why have you forsaken me? That's Psalm 22, verse 1. And then many other parts of those details are also prophesied in other places in the Old Testament. So the point is, the suffering and the death of Jesus and the details about his death and his suffering are found in the Old Testament as being declared God's will. That this is something God planned and wanted and to happen and said would happen. So as Jesus is mocked, as he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? As he's surrounded by evildoers, as they cast lots for his garments, this is the fulfilling of God's will. This is not a sign that Jesus has failed to do the will of God. This is he's doing the will of God. What an irony. This is what makes Jesus' death on a cross unique from every other one. I mean, dying on a cross was not unique. Thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people were crucified on a cross. So what makes Jesus so special? Because as he dies on that cross, he's fulfilling the will of God. Now, what was the purpose of him being assigned that destiny by God, that he would die in such a horrible way? That brings us to the third irony. And that's the taunt of chapter 15, verse 31b. They taunted him. "He saved others, but he cannot save himself." But that taunt holds the truth of God's good news to us. They mean it as an insult. Oh, look how weak he is. They mean it as an exclamation of victory. The chief priests, as they said that, you know, "See, we've beaten him. He can't save himself. He saved others, but we've beat him. He's on the cross." But actually, they don't know what they're saying. They're declaring the truth of God. They're declaring the gospel. The mockers admitted that Jesus saved others. And as we've gone through this gospel, we've seen how Jesus saved others. The hemorrhaging woman, the disciples on the Sea of Galilee when the storm came up, you know, they woke him up. "Do you not care? We're going to drown." And he stops the wind and the waves. He saved people from being possessed or inhabited with demons. He raised people from the dead. He saved lepers from their disease and people who were paralyzed. They admitted that, but they believed, as they stated in Mark chapter 3, verse 22, that Jesus saved others not by the power of God, but by the power of Satan. They believed that Satan cast out demons by the power of Satan, and thus he also healed that way as well. They thought the power source behind Jesus was the devil. And so the mockers look as they see Jesus on the cross. They say, this clinches it for us. This proves to us that God was never behind you, Jesus. Because in our understanding, the chief priests and the Sanhedrin, the religious leaders are thinking, God would never let his Christ die. Never let the Messiah die the death of a lowlife on a cross. So he would never let his Messiah be cursed. So you see, Jesus, you saved others, but you can't save yourself, and God's not going to save you. But they do not realize what they're saying. Because if Jesus is going to truly save others, he cannot come off that cross. He has to stay on the cross. Because by dying on the cross, that's how he's going to save many, many others. Do you remember what he said earlier in chapter 10, verse 45? He came to give his life as a ransom. Give his life. Die. In the place of others. And what did he say? We looked at it not too long ago from chapter 14, verse 22. He said he was going to shed his blood. This is his blood shed for you, the blood of the new covenant. He can't make the new covenant if he comes off the cross. He can't be a ransom if he comes off the cross. That's why he has to stay on it. That's how he's going to save people. If he doesn't die, he'll save no one. So again, it's like the seed or the grain that goes into the ground. John, I think, the Gospel of John refers to that. You know, a seed has to go into the ground, or a grain of wheat has to go into the ground. It has to die. It has to give up itself. And then, you know, the new plant comes up and you get a whole new stalk with multiple grains. So in the same concept, Jesus has to die to save the many. So as they taunted him, as they mocked him on the cross, you cannot save yourself, what did they see? They saw a defeated, powerless, humiliated, good-for-nothing false prophet that they had been trying to kill and destroy since Mark chapter 3, verse 6. But it was not that they had finally won the power struggle and got rid of Jesus. It's not that they had finally defeated him and they had more strength than he did, and that's why he had to stay on the cross, because they beat him. No, not at all. Jesus said what at the garden, at his arrest, when one of his disciples, Peter, got a little overenthusiastic and took a swipe at someone with a sword? What did Jesus say? Put your sword away, Peter. Matthew 26, 53 to 54. Do you not think I can appeal to my Father and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? But how then should the scriptures be fulfilled? That it must be so. So clearly, it's not a lack of power that kept Jesus on the cross. It's not because he was weak and powerless. And that's why he was on the cross. It was because it was his will, and it was the will of God the Father. And it was because of their love for us guilty, hateful rebels that held him there. That's why he did not come down off the cross and slap them all silly. He stayed on the cross because of his love, and it was the will of God the Father. It was written, it was foretold. These things must happen. That's the great irony then. He was doing the will of God, and he was saving others by staying on the cross. Now, in this account of the crucifixion, with one of its key focuses being the mocking of Jesus, there is a lone, solitary voice. One voice that speaks up to honor Jesus. And the honor comes from a very unlikely person, the Roman centurion, the guy who's in charge of the soldiers who's crucifying Jesus. Verse 39, and when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, truly, this man was the Son of God. Now that's an astounding statement to come from his lips for a number of reasons. First of all, because in the Gospel of Mark, this is the first time a human admits that Jesus is the Son of God. From the time the gospel begins in Mark chapter 1, verse 1, up until this verse, and the gospel's almost finished, the only beings that said Jesus was the Son of God was God the Father and demons. No human does. Not in the Gospel of Mark. In the other Gospels, yes. But not in this Gospel. Secondly, this is an astounding statement because it's from a non-Jew. It's from a Gentile. Why isn't one of Jesus' disciples in this Gospel stating this? Why isn't one of those who have followed him? No, it's a non-Jew who is the first one to say Jesus is the Son of God. Well, this can be seen as the beginning of another fulfillment of prophecy from Psalm 22. Psalm 22, 27 to 28 says, "All the ends of the earth shall remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations shall worship before you, for kingship belongs to the Lord, and he rules over the nations." So in this statement, you could see the nations beginning, the beginning of this prophecy being fulfilled, that this non-Jew at the foot of the cross starts to call Jesus the Son of God. And then the third and the most interesting reason why this is so astounding is because this statement is made as a response to how he sees Jesus die. And he makes it contrary to what everybody else is saying. The crowds and the general public are saying, you know, mocking Jesus, "You deserve to die. You're nothing. You're no good. You're just a false prophet, a demon-possessed man." And this guy says, the lone voice, "This is the Son of God." To others, when they pass by and they looked at Jesus' suffering and his death, it called up out of them blasphemous words. But when the centurion saw Jesus die, it inspired in him and brought out of him a confession of honor, and perhaps I would even go so far as some kind of faith in Jesus. This is what Jesus' death brought out of the centurion. Surely this man is the Son of God. Now, what exactly the centurion means when he says Jesus was the Son of God, it's a little bit uncertain. Unlike the Jews, the Romans had no problem calling a human the Son of God. You know, with their emperor worship, Caesar Augustus was called the Son of God. Many of their emperors just simply claimed to be a god. But what is striking, and David Garland points out, that if this centurion is going to call Jesus the Son of God, it definitely means he has changed his concept and changed his understanding about what the concept of the Son of God means. Because to a Roman, they would only associate the Son of God with power, splendor, and the might of the Roman Empire. But that's not what he just witnessed. That's not what the centurion just saw. So something has radically changed his mind and his concept of this phrase or title, the Son of God, so that he would apply it to Jesus, who is exhibiting weakness, surrender, suffering, and death. Something has radically changed in his mind. As Paul told the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 23, he said to the non-Jewish people, to the Romans and the Greeks, the message that Jesus was crucified, that a God would die, to them, they said that's foolishness, that's stupidity. So for the centurion to say, this surely is the Son of God, in this context, seeing his death, Jesus' death, this is astounding. He does not see it as foolishness. He sees it as wisdom, as truth. In Matthew chapter 27, verse 40 and 43, the mockers did use the title Son of God. So as they mocked Jesus on the cross, they said, you know, "You who claim to be the Son of God, come down off the cross." So they heard The centurion heard the mockers use that title and mock him with it. But the centurion, by saying this, "Surely this is the Son of God," he reverses the Sanhedrin's verdict back from Mark 14, 61 to 64. Because when Jesus said, "I am the Son," you know, he says, "Yeah, I'm the Son of God. You'll see me come in the right hand, or you'll see me come in the clouds and power and all this, and see me seated at the right hand of God." They said, "This is blasphemy. You're not the Son of God." The centurion, by saying, "This truly is the Son of God," he's reversing their verdict. He's saying they're wrong. And he's saying the crowds are wrong. And he's saying his own soldiers who mocked Jesus before is wrong. He's the sole voice going contrary to all the others. And he's even probably going against his own previous understanding of what it meant to be a Son of God. Just as the mockers didn't know the truth of what they were saying when they shouted in hate, "He saved others, but he can't save himself," the centurion is probably saying more than he knows. But this is the point the writer of this gospel wants us, the reader, to grasp. So he had wrote this gospel, likely, as I said when we began the series, to those in Rome. And so as the Romans are reading this gospel and having read it all the way through, he's wanting the reader in Rome, after having read about what Jesus did and what Jesus taught and what he said and his actions, the author wants the readers to understand that this Jesus is the Son of God, that he is the divine Son of God, equal to God in character and being, to understand that it was God who died in their place on that cross in fulfillment of Scripture according to the plan of God from eternity past, and that if we would but call out to Jesus, we too can be forgiven of our sin, and we too can come back into a right relationship with God by his grace given to us in Jesus. Here's a thought that I want you to take home and continue to think over in your mind over in this week and further beyond this week. The thought is this: the power of the gospel about the Son of God, that is Jesus, to change our lives is in the proclamation of his death and his resurrection. So if we're going to be changed, freed from sin and death, the power that changes us and is made available for us, that good news, is found as we talk and as we teach and as we share about the death of Christ and his resurrection. If we really want to understand who Jesus is, we need to look at the cross and his suffering. That's where his identity is most clearly seen. That's where his whole life makes sense, at the cross and the resurrection. David Garland reflects upon the centurion in this way. He says that the cross reveals God's love and power that will win over to God, or bring to God, those we would never even dream of coming to God. Look at the centurion. He'd be one of the last people we would think would come to God to begin to grasp who Jesus is. The centurion took part in overseeing Jesus' death. He heard all the mocking and the rejection of Jesus. Culturally, he didn't associate deity with weakness and suffering and a dying Jew. But seeing not Jesus' miracles, but seeing Jesus' death, he is compelled to shout out as the lone voice, "Surely this is the Son of God." What changed him? It was the death of Christ. It is the proclamation that we proclaim about Jesus' death that will also bring others to God. Jackie Hill Perry, she's a hip-hop artist. Those of you who took the Messy Grace course, the 20 of you who were in that. You know who Jackie Hill is. We got introduced to her. Jackie Hill Perry was taken to church as a very, very young girl by a relative. And she remembers, she goes, you know, I found church boring, but she liked the popcorn and the Skittles. But listen to what she remembered from her exposure to the church at a very, very young age. This is what she remembers later as an adult. And I quote, "I just remember what stuck was that Jesus died." That's talked about a lot, especially in Sunday school. You go and you see the picture of him with the lambs and how he was the lamb that was slain. And I didn't necessarily know what all that meant. But I did know that Jesus died for sinners so they could be forgiven. End of quote. Now Jackie, after that, would leave the church, would not continue to be associated with the church, and she would make some terrible choices and start to go down a very, very dark road. But later in her teens, in her late teens, as she tells us, God began to show her the lack of peace in her life. And he also showed her at the age 19. When she was 19, he made it very clear to her. He told her, "The sin that you love is going to be the death of you." And she says, at that moment, at 19, when God impressed that upon me, I realized it's no longer just a piece of information that sin brings death. It's reality. And I realized that if I stayed and continued to embrace the sin that I was following and loving and cherishing and living out of my life, I will die. Faced with that reality, I quote what she says. "When I reckoned with that, I knew I could not save myself. I knew I could not walk away from these things because I enjoyed them way too much. And so I knew from Bible study at church when I was 5 years old, you died," and she's referring to Jesus, "you died for people like me. You said you'd forgive people like me, and so I'll just believe that." End of quote. So under the conviction of the Holy Spirit, realizing that she is sinful and offended God and is judged and condemned for that rightfully, as she understood the reality of death and sin, then she was reminded of what she learned when she was 5 at church, that Jesus died for people like her and people like me and people like you. Died for sinners. And that is what caused the change. That is what brought her to God. His death in her place that he did many, many thousands of years ago. That's what brought her new life. That message of his death. Remember again the words of Paul from 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 18, 21 to 25. "For the word," or the message of the cross, "is folly," or foolishness, "to those who are perishing. But to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly or the foolishness of what we preach to save those who believe." Question, well, what is preached that saves those who believe, that God works through? Well, let's continue. "For Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. A stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Go and proclaim the Lord's death until he comes." I invite the music team to come forward.
We're going to close with hymn number 178, O Sacred Head Now Wounded. And it too tells the story. The first verse tells us what Jesus went through. The second verse tells us why he went through it. And the third one tells us how impossible it is for us to really thank him for what he's done for us. And it's amazing. I was just looking at it, and it was the words of this song originally were written about 800 years ago. So somebody was thinking about this 800 years ago and writing a song for us. And then the music was written by J.S. Bach, or completed by him, probably over 250 years ago. And this is our heritage. This is something that has gone down through the years. So when you stand up and sing this, and you think about what Christ has done for you as you sing this song, other people have been doing it for hundreds of years. So let's do it together.
Continue steadfastly in prayer and being watchful in it with thanksgiving. May God open a door for each of you to declare the word, the mystery, and the cross of Christ as clearly as you ought. Amen. Please be seated.